Hey, welcome to the Meat House, and thanks for listening to episode 223. I'm Jeff, and today I am joined by my guest, Michael Labonte. He is our third place winner for the Iron Bee 2021. We'll be talking about his entry and some of the stuff that he has been up to since the competition happened. Hey, thank you for listening to the Meat House podcast. You can find us everywhere. We're on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Spotify, our iHeartRadio, YouTube, Amazon Music. You can find the whole list over at our website, www.themeathouse.com. And hey, before we get rolling, I also need to say thank you to our Key Holders Club. They are doing their part to keep this podcast free. You too can join up for as little as $2 a month. You'll get some cool thank you gifts and rewards, Key Holder content. Just search for The Meat House over at patreon.com or click on the link in the show notes. So as far as what we are drinking tonight, I have in Meat House fashion two drinks in front of me here. The first one comes from my former co-host, Ryan. This was listed as a Belgian double braggot. It is dark, very carbonated. Has some nice toasty notes in it. I'm not sure what kind of honey he used, but it's of the braggot part is the beer part of the braggot is definitely coming forward here. I've got those toasty notes. There's some lingering bitterness on the aftertaste. It's a nice drink. It's got a very heavy body to it too. It's pretty good. And then in my other glass, I have the extra bottle from our guests, Iron Bee 2021 entry. This is the first time I'm going to try it. This is a chocolate ginger passion. And let's see, it is brilliantly clear, a nice deep yellow color. I'm getting some honey and some tropical fruit on the nose. There's a hint of tartness at the very start, and then it kind of gives way to some sweetness, and I think the chocolate is coming through and that mid palate as well. And there's some a kind of a tropical fruit flavor to it as well there towards the end. Michael, what are you drinking tonight?
Tonight I am single fisting it because it's only like 2 o'clock right here. But this is actually from Ben Daniels. You might have seen him in some of the groups or whatever. This is a Riesling, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, but Mamani Piment. And I'm getting it's definitely very clear. It's a little bit darker than a traditional Riesling, but very clear. Aroma, I get a little bit of coconut and maybe a little petrol. Let's see for the flavor. Oh, yeah, this is really good. It's definitely semi-sweet. I'm getting a little bit of apricot, pear, maybe a little peach in there. Almost a little bit of vanilla, too. It's very good, though.
Well, let's jump into the Iron Bee 2021. The secret ingredient, the passion flower, was a little bit of a challenge this year. What were some of your initial thoughts when you got that secret ingredient?
Well, I would say my initial thought would probably have been like, you know, what do I do with this? But I ended up looking on Google, and it said it's mostly used for like a tea or whatever. So I made a little bit of tea out of it, and I tried it. And I kind of thought that it would go pretty well with ginger. So from there, I basically just Googled recipes that have ginger and passion flower in them. And I didn't find much. So I kept scrolling and I ended up coming across a candy bar. I think it was like for like hotels or something, like to leave on like pillows. Mm-hmm. And I ended up just kind of rolling with that. That's where I got the idea from.
So let's talk about what's in my glass here. You've got, you said the the ingredient, I'm sorry, the entry name is all I have to go by on ingredients. So I'm guessing there's chocolate in here, there's ginger in here, and there's passion flower. What was your approach to making this here?
Well, it's pretty much that. I mean, what I basically did was I started off with a tea. Like, I only did a 1 gallon batch of it, but I did 1 gallon of the passion flower tea. I did some lehua blossom, some macadamia nut blossom. And then I did the ginger right in primary. And then when I went over to secondary, I did the toasted cocoa nibs. And I did do, I always do a little bit of vanilla whenever I do chocolate, almost like baking a cake, you know?
Sure. Makes sense.
Yeah. And I mean, that's essentially it, you know, like it's kind of a matter of, you know, toying with it and playing around with it a little bit, but.
Now you said you added the ginger in primary. How much ginger did you use and like what kind of a format was it in? Was it dried? Was it fresh?
Well, it was just regular ginger. I chopped it up. I skinned it. I chopped it up. To be honest, I don't even remember. Like, it's kind of a matter of just playing around with it and seeing what the right amount was. I'd probably say I used like a piece, like the size of my thumb.
All right. That's fair. Yeah, I'm just trying this again. And I, you know, the problem with tasting this, of course, 6 months after the fact is that I feel like the ginger may have faded out a little bit. It's it's not as sharp as I expect ginger to be in presentation, but it's, you know, when you look for it, it's there.
I'm surprised you were even able to get a bottle of it.
Yeah, Ryan was nice enough to hold on to the extras that he had from judging, and it shot me at least the secret ingredient bottle, so I've got those to try when I interview you guys on this one. And this is, it's, you know, nice to be able to talk about it, even if the profile of the meat has probably changed in the intervening 6 months or so.
Yeah, I almost wish I held on a little bit of it myself. I mean, it was only a 1 gallon batch, so I went through it pretty quick, but
And that is the problem with 1 gallon batches, but you know, you keep notes and you can always repeat it if you like it.
Yeah. I mean, especially with the secret ingredient, I had no idea how it was going to come out, you know? So I was like, I don't want to do 5 gallons of this right now.
Right. Yeah. And I think, I think a lot of our participants were in that same boat where they, you know, they smelled it and then they made a tea with it and they went, the heck is this?
I have some of it in my fridge.
Well, I know I got a lot of flack when we first released the ingredients with people sending me comments like, so, you know, this tastes like a barn, right? Like a hayloft.
Yeah, it's very grassy.
It has an earthy quality to it, a little bit of sweetness, but I think it was definitely upping the challenge game this year as opposed to years past. Not that years past were not challenging, but this was a little bit of another nudge in that direction. So since Iron Bee 2021, what have you been up to?
Like as far as brewing goes, kind of a lot, kind of not a lot. You know, I've kind of really been toning it down on my experimental batches. I've been doing a lot of traditionals. You know, I've got a couple macadamia blossom. I believe it's pronounced Ule. I always have trouble with the Hawaiian names.
I understand. Yeah.
Yeah. Can't think. I mean, I've been doing a lot of beer lately, so my mead's been slacking a little bit. But I know I've got a raspberry cherry one with hibiscus and rose petals going right now. Mostly bigger batches, but more classic takes. I did a pie mint recently, Pinot Grigio pie mint.
Cool.
Yeah.
And I take it a lot of these, like the macadamia and the, I'm probably going to butcher this too, the Ule blossom, those are coming from our friend Sean over at, is it
Island
Buzz Honey?
I get almost all of my honey from Sean. I get a little bit of it from, you know, Walker or Gardner bees, but most of it does end up coming from Sean. I love those tropical flavors. His macadamia blossom is delicious. It's so rich and buttery. It's one of my favorite honeys of all time.
I don't think I've tried his macadamia. I need to, but I know I'm risking my marriage every time I see one of those posts and shoot him a message like, "Hey, Sean, here you got some tangerine blossom. Let's get a little bit sent over to Missouri here."
I'll have to send you a macadamia blossom. I have the traditional going right now. It's still in primary, but I'll have to send you one once it's all done. There's macadamia blossom in the one you're drinking right now.
Hmm.
But it's like half and half.
I couldn't tell you the character of the macadamia blossom honey off the top of my head. It's been
an age. Yeah, especially with all the other flavors.
I wonder if that's part of the tropical fruit flavor that I'm kind of getting on the back end here. It could be that, or it could be kind of the remaining qualities of the ginger there too. Not sure.
I think to me the Lahua has a little bit more tropical flavor than the macadamia. I mean, the Lahua is light. It's kind of got a almost a vanilla character to it too, like a creaminess. But the macadamia is a little bit more rich, nutty, buttery type of honey. It's honestly one of my favorite for traditionals or sizers. Sizers go very well with it.
I can see that, sure. So let's talk traditionals for a little bit. They always say if you want to improve your meat game, make a traditional because there's nothing to hide behind there. What kind of approaches have you been taking with these traditionals that you're making?
So I do a couple things in it. I mean, it really depends on what my goal is with the specific traditional and certain things. Sure. Like that. Like the one that I did with the Ule blossom, that actually has a little bit of Eastern buckwheat in it too. And it kind of darkened it up a little bit. It gave it a more complex flavor, I feel like. But it was just a very, very little bit of it. I add a lot of things like Opta White to certain ones. Sometimes I'll add, if I'm not planning on oaking it, I'll add some tannins in primary just to get that that body and a little bit more sure. complexity into it.
Now, I assume you've tried without the Opta White and you've tried with it. What kind of results are you seeing from that? Is it a positive, you think, or is this still kind of early phases of experimentation?
I think that from the couple of them that I've done with it, I would say that it definitely improves the body a lot. It gives it more mouthfeel. They say that there's some color stability. I don't see a huge difference in that. Yeah, to be honest, like it's relatively early in the experimental stages with it, so I can't give you like a definitive answer.
Sure, no, that's fine. I've been playing with like Opta White, Opta Red, and the Rouge Boost and things like that myself a little bit, but I think it's also too early to tell on my side as well, especially because with move and house renovations and stuff, where my brewing is not nearly as voluminous as it has been in previous.
I've been cutting down.
What's your yeast selection look like for those traditionals? Are you going for like a Kvike yeast or something more traditional? Are you going more clean or trying to get some different yeast character out of it?
So for a lot of my traditionals, especially if it's like my first time using a honey or something like that, I like to just use my standard go-to yeast, which is QA23. But for certain ones I had, like I did recently, actually for the 4th of July, my parents had a party. So I did a mango blossom traditional, and I used, it's called Kviking, and it's a blend of three different Kvike strands. And I did that in like the 90 degree range to kind of emphasize those fruity esters. I thought that would go pretty good on tap.
How'd it turn out?
It turned out pretty good. Yeah. I mean, people seem to like it. It was a semi-sweet, very fruity esters to it, citrusy. I would definitely use that yeast again and some other ones. I tend to like the Kvike strands. They add a lot of fruity esters, and they ferment so quick, you know. You really don't have to waste any time. You front load all your nutrients and crank the heat up to 90 degrees and you're good to go.
Yeah, no, there is a lot to love about the Kvikes. They do so much so quickly, and they add to it without hardly any downsides other than, you know, I feel like I burn through a lot more nutrient shooting at the 90, 95 degrees than I do fermenting in the 70s. But, I mean, small price to pay.
Yeah, for sure. It definitely has some high nutrient demands to it. But, you know, you could have a batch, like, especially if you're doing, like, a session on tap, you could have a batch done in, like, a week, you know? I mean, it'll be done fermenting before then probably, but drop some super clear in it and it's good to go.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I keep saying I keep referencing, I had a talk on session meats. This must have been like 3 years ago now, where I did a session meat with a Kvike, and it was in bottle and ready to drink after 9 days. One of those days was for like secondary flavoring, and one of those days was for carbonation. So, I mean, it probably could have been drinkable as was like 6 days in.
Yeah, for sure. I'm a big fan of the Kvikes also with those, like, the more tropical type of honeys, you know, like the mango blossoms, orange blossoms. I actually did an orange blossom traditional recently that had the Voss Kvike in it, and that came out pretty good too. It almost tastes like there's orange in it, you know, but there is just a traditional.
Oh, yeah. No, I did a bracket with a it was Kvike and just like basic Pilsner malt, and I sent that into a competition, I want to say like 2-3 years ago, just on a whim. And one of the judges was like, "You failed to mention that you added orange juice to this."
Oh, wow.
I was like, well, you know, I didn't, but thank you. That proves that Kvike is really kicking it.
Oh, yeah.
So, no, I do really enjoy a lot of those Kvike strains, and Voss is one of my favorites.
Yeah, they tend, honestly, even for like braggots, like especially in the summertime, you really can't beat it. Even if you're not doing it at like 90 degrees, you can't beat the fact that you don't need temperature control.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm a notorious cheapskate, so my house is usually at like 74, 75 degrees in the summertime. And, man, I thought years and years ago when I stumbled on fermenting meats with a Saison yeast, I thought that was revolutionary. And now with Kvike on the table, it's like, wow.
Yeah. I know you don't normally get the questions, but what are you working on out of curiosity? You got anything going?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the moment I'm working on, I just got my wife's sangria recipe going. I talked about that, I want to say, three episodes back.
Yeah, it was the first episode back.
Yeah. And so we've got that going. That's in primary now and bubbling away. You know, it's 71B, so I'm expecting it's going to be a couple weeks before I get to, you know, do any secondary stuff or playing with it. And if I really have my druthers this weekend, I'm looking at putting together a 3-gallon batch of like a blueberry session with some Kvike, and I'm trying to decide which of these, you know, these massive number of hops I have in front of me are going to go into it. I'm thinking either some Azakas or some, we've got some of these Pink Boots blends that came, I want to say that it was IRON-B 2020. They were one of our like bracket shootout giveaways. And I've still got a handful of those left that I could easily throw in here too. They've got a pretty good blend of different, you know, tropical-ish hop flavors in them, between, you know, there's some Zaka, some Simcoe, I want to say some Laurel. Oh, I can't remember for the life of me what else is in it. It's the that Idaho one with the weird coconut flavors, so that could be interesting.
The Sabro?
I might be thinking of a different hop. I know it's the one that it used to be an experimental hop, and they called it Idaho 7 after a while. That might not be the coconut one. I know Sabro has that coconut flavor. So I might be mistaken on that front. But yeah, it's that blend is. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Sabro hops. Anything like with those tropical notes, especially in like IPAs and stuff, but I even like dry hopping the certain styles of meads and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think as far as summer meads go, I'm going to get a lot of play out of just a simple like session mead with some fruit and some hops and just carbonate the hell out of it. That sounds delightful to me. So we'll be expecting some content about that here coming up soon too.
Now, when you do your fruit meads, do you like the session ones? Do you use any of the OptiRed or anything like that?
I have been using the either OptiRed or Bruges Boost. I'm debating whether I want to use like an OptiRed or if I want to treat these because I'm using. Yeah, I got the like the bulk bag of the was it Wyman's Wild Maine blueberries from Costco. I think it's like a 4 pound bag. I usually use the freeze thaw method to break those up and get some, get past the skins because otherwise that the yeast has a hard time getting in there and getting into the fruit of the mead.
Do you use any enzymes too, or?
Well, that's one of the things I'm noodling over, whether I want to get some lalazyme in there, which, I've talked to, John Jacob, who was our second place winner, and we'll have that interview coming out soon, listeners. But that there were some technical issues there, so he was talking about using that for his blueberries and how ridiculously effective it was. So I'm curious about throwing some of that in there too.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the lalazyme. It's which one is it? The lalazyme EXV or whatever.
Yes, I think he was talking about using the EX and the effectiveness he was getting out of it. Yes.
Okay. So I could see that being pretty good. I've heard good things about the EX, or I believe it's the EX or EXV. The EXV, I think, is supposed to hold on to tannins a little bit better long term.
Yeah, I know they have different strains of that lalazyme, and some of them are more geared towards red wine versus like white wine. Obviously, it's for the winery industry that they develop those, but the same kind of anthocyanins and other compounds that give the red wine its color, they're going to be present in dark fruit like blueberries or blackberries or things like that too. So it would make sense that it would help in that regard. Yeah. No, and then as far as other projects go, I'm also looking at, they've been sitting around for a little while here. I've got some cans from our friends over in Brewfirm, those, the malt Belgian beers. I'm looking at doing just a simple one of those. I think they come in 3 and 4 gallon varieties, maybe doctoring those up with some honey and some additional hops and getting those on tap. Again, like I mentioned in that first episode back, I've got this the Keezer in my basement that is still in the tuning phases as far as getting carbonation right on it. So that gives me just that much more ample opportunity to play with that and kind of get it, nailed down.
Are you using the same regulator for all your kegs, or?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I just have the. Well, I have the one regulator that it's attached to my gas can, and then that goes into a manifold that splits it between different kegs. At the moment, I'm only actually running one keg, so I've been skipping the manifold and just like basically attaching it directly to the gas can when I need it on tap, so to speak, and then topping up the gas levels when I leave it to sit.
Okay. Yeah, I have a similar situation in my house. I just have one keg right now, but I literally just put actually a couple of minutes before we started talking cream ale on tap.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. It's not a braggart or anything like that, but it should be interesting.
Hey, cream ale makes a great summer drink. I'm 100% behind that one.
Yeah, I figured it'd be good lawnmower beer.
Excuse me. I tried drinking some mead and got some down the wrong pipe there. yeah, no, the session meads are kind of my lawnmower braggot of, or lawnmower braggot. The session meads are kind of my lawnmower mead of choice in that same regard there. So, your cream ale, did you take that from a kit? Did that come from a recipe you developed? How did you start with that?
I just kind of come up with, like, I'm not like a beer expert. Like, I'm not, I'm not an anything expert, but, I just kind of made up the grain bill on Bearsmith. I use Bearsmith for like everything, mm-hmm. but it's pretty simple. It's like, I don't remember off the top of my head exactly, but you know, maybe like 20% corn, some two row, mostly two row is like the base malt, and then some Carafoam.
Sure.
I ended up dry hopping with a little bit of Sabro actually, because I do Sabro for everything, but just like a light dry hop. Like we're talking 2 days at like a lower temperature.
Mm-hmm. Have you gotten to taste it yet, or is it still carving up there for you?
I literally just kegged it like right before we started talking, so it's not even close to carbed yet. I am, to be honest, I am probably going to do the cheap method of like crank it up to 25 PSI and shake it and stuff like that. So hopefully, it'll be ready soon.
That's generally how I do it, and I.
It's for the impatient people, you know.
It really is. I mean, you know, you get through all that trouble and then they're like, you mean I got to sit on this for another week before I can even drink it? Kidding me.
Sometimes longer than that. Sometimes if I do it at like, sometimes I like to, if I had multiple taps, I would totally just put it at like 7 PSI and just leave it for like 2 weeks or something like that. Sometimes, depending on what style it is. But yeah, I mean, most of the time I end up just cranking up to 25 and shaking it because I only have one keg, so
yeah. No, once I have some backlog on my kegs, I might be a little bit more inclined to patience, but for the moment, yeah, I'm in that whole let's just shake the living hell out of it and get as much carbonation in there as quick as we can so I can actually drink this thing.
Yeah, you're always curious too, you know. You're like, how is it going to come out? Like right now I have no idea how it tastes. I didn't even taste it still, so.
Yeah, and the waiting is the hardest part. It really is, especially like, you know, when you're making it and you have all these ideas as far as how it's going to taste, and then you're really just curious as to what the final result was.
You would think we would have more patience making mead all the time, and then like go over to beer where it takes like one week, 2 weeks to ferment, you know, but still no patience.
No, I was talking about this with a couple of friends of mine the other night that were kind of interested in homebrewing, the differences in time as far as just making and things like that. And the long and short of it that I gave them was, you know, yeah, beer. If you're going to make beer and you're going to make it like, you know, you choose the grains and things like that, that's basically an all-day affair. If you're going to make a mead, you can probably get your brew put together in an hour. But then, you know, you could be drinking that beer in like a week or two versus a mead. You might be sitting on that for a few months to get something you actually enjoy. And
yeah, for sure.
It ultimately comes down to where you want to put the patience, I think.
Yeah, that's why I lean towards mead a little bit, because I could just whip it up in, you know, honestly, even like to say an hour, like I feel like I could do it in like 20 minutes sometimes, depending on the style and stuff like that. But beer, it's like, you know, you're dedicating, I don't want to say an all day thing, but like, you know, 2-3 hours, kind of.
Yeah.
Including cleanup, well, you know.
Oh, yeah. Then you got to get the beer up to temperature. You got to do there are so many different steps in it that it does feel like it takes multiple hours. And even if you're not like actively engaged all the time, you've got to kind of have one eye on the beer while you're doing whatever else you're doing versus, yeah, no, I think a mead or a, Now, even a wine or a cider, you're basically just throwing the ingredients together, putting some yeast in it, and calling it good.
Yep. 100%. Well, you know, with the cider, I mean, like, it depends. Are you pressing it? You know, if you're pressing it, it takes a little bit longer, but.
This is true. Yeah. If you're not just using a pre-pressed apple juice or something like that, then you have a good deal more effort involved in getting the cider before you can throw yeast into it.
I'm fortunate enough to live right next to an orchard, so I always get my apples right there.
Yeah, there's a cider place that's south of town, and during that season, if I want cider stuff, they'll let you come in on I think Saturday mornings. It's been years since I've done it, and I hope they still do it. But I was like, hey, I want to get, you know, 6 gallons of fresh cider. And okay, I paid for it, and they're like, okay, go around back. I went in, and there's just a couple guys using this huge press. All the cider's dumping through it, and they've got a hose coming off the bottom that goes into their, like, bottling line or whatever. They're like, okay. They take the hose out of the bottling line, put it in my bucket, and in, like, 5 seconds, I've got an entire bucket full of cider.
Oh, yeah, that's great. I've actually I made friends with go on.
No, please, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I made friends with a local cider guy in Connecticut. In fact, if anybody listening is from Connecticut, shout out to Spoken Spy Cidery. But the guy, Ron, he's a great guy. He's a cider wizard. And he every now and then he'll pick up some cider, and he sells it to me for a pretty good price. And there was actually one time where they did at our local brewery, Ron brought his press down to down to the brewery, and they were pressing. I guess the brewery had a bunch of apples donated to them. I'm not sure what kind of apples or what variety they were, but they were just donated to them, and they were pressing them for free, and you just fill up your bucket for free.
Score. Nice.
Yeah, that was a great one, and it came out pretty good. I mean, like, I'm a limited knowledge person when it comes to cider, but I thought it was delicious.
Yeah, and if it works out like that, it works out. I mean, you know, cider is one of those things you can go off the deep end and get your very precise ratios of, you know, this apple and that apple and things like that. Or you can take a really simple approach of, okay, here's some apple juice, here's some yeast, give it a week or two, drink.
Yeah, that's usually my method, just because I don't know enough about apple varieties. But
I don't think there's any shame in that, man. There are people that take the long approach, like your buddy there at the Cider Works. But you know, anything that I've tried to make apples with, it just seems like it really apple juice just wants to ferment. Natural yeast in the air will get into that and just go. And usually, more often than not, at least from my experience, the end result is fine. So it can definitely be a less is more kind of approach to it.
Yeah, for sure. The tough thing too is that a lot of the orchards nowadays have, at least in America, have all the post prohibition apples, you know, like the table apples or the baking apples and stuff like that. We don't really have a lot of cider apples.
Yeah, you know, you're looking for the bitter sharps or whatever the term for those is. I think that's right, but I could be wrong. Where they have a lot more of the acid and the character that's gonna like remain after that sweetness goes away, and it's just not there. But
yeah, I know people do the. What was that?
Nothing. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I know a lot of people do the crab apples. The crab apples seem to add nice tartness or something like that to it.
No, I've heard a lot of people recommend, that was actually what I was going to say as well. I've heard people recommending using crab apples for at least like, you know, 5 to 10% of your cider, just to add some of that sharpness and the bitterness to it. And, I really briefly experimented with like picking some crab apples from a tree that's grown in my backyard at the new house here. They all got moldy over the winter. Unfortunately, I guess store them frozen enough to do anything with, but we'll probably try that this fall here too, not to give any spoilers to our audience.
Oh yeah, that's cool that you got a crab apple tree in your new. This is a new yard, right? You're talking.
Yeah, yeah. We. Sorry, we keep stepping over each other's lines. yeah, we moved a little over a year ago now, and the new house has a. I gather the previous homeowner just had the crab apple tree there because it was decorative and nice, but I immediately looked at that and went, I can do something with this.
Do you have a lot of other things growing in your yard?
Not really. There's a couple of larger maples in the backyard, and then a Rose of Sharon, which is, you know, it's a big bee attractor at the moment because it's blooming, but nothing really fruiting. I put in some blackberry plants on one side of my house, but they're not doing so great. We'll see if they, you know, really take off. My green thumb is a little withered and brown, so certainly no Kentram in that regard.
Yeah, we just bought our house I want to say 3 years ago, maybe 2 years ago. Well, it'd probably be 3 years ago. And we get some interesting wild fruits and stuff. We get some, I think they're mulberries, and we get some raspberries. And some nice. Wild grapes. Yeah, so it's always interesting to do like that one. It's not like a lot, you know, but it's enough to do at least one gallon batch of just the yard stuff, you know. Throw some of the raspberries in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Some grapes and stuff like that. I think they're like Concord grapes or something like that.
Yeah, we had a mulberry tree in our previous backyard that was growing into the fence line, so it was more of a prodigious bush than a tree. But if it was a particularly good year, I could get enough to do a gallon or two batch and put up a nice mulberry mead. So I'm trying to persuade the wife to let me put in some plums or some other like fruit trees in here, but she's kind of dead set on the fact that there are some really big pine trees in the front yard that need to be gone first before we add any more foliage to our yard.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've got too many trees in my yard. I need to get rid of some of them, but I do want to get some. I like just having those like fruit trees and stuff like that. I mean, we do a medium garden, I should say. But I like being able to take those things from outside of our yard and stuff like that and incorporate them into like a meat or something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's nice to have something like a base ingredient that is yours and came from your area to throw into something you're making as opposed to like something you bought at the store. Feels more personal.
Oh yeah. Yeah, 100%. I honestly feel like it tastes better too. Like I could be wrong. It may be like one of those subconscious things, but anything from our garden always ends up tasting better than what we would get at the store. You know, we try to keep everything mm-hmm. like organic and stuff all the way down to the soil. So
sure. Well, and one of the raspberry or blackberry bushes that I tried to put in was a golden raspberry variety, and apparently, you know, those are. The fruit on those is so tender that it ends up getting like smushed or ruined just in the whole packing and processing thing. So you never see those in stores because it just doesn't stay. It doesn't have any like shelf stability. So I'm really curious to play with those if I can get that plant to thrive. But that's the open question right now.
I wonder what the color of that would also come out. It would probably be like a very golden hue to it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think like a dark yellow or something in the gold, or, you know, for lack of a better term, honey color.
Yeah.
Well, let's see here. I have kept you for a while here, Michael. Do you have any Any parting advice for our listeners as far as, you know, for new listeners, for people that are trying new things? Any, like, the big aha moments that have come with your particular journey?
You know what? That's a good question. I guess I would probably say just keep learning, you know, just keep trying to take as much as you can, you know, and don't let your ego get in the way of learning more things, you know. Just because you made a good mead, you know, doesn't mean that you could learn more and improve on it, you know, if that makes any sense.
Oh, absolutely. No, I recall the first time I sent something off to a competition and actually won a medal for it off the hand. I was like, oh my God, I must be the best mead maker ever. And no, I have come so far since those days that it's, you got to get out of your own head and just, you know, focus on the process, just always making things better each step along the way. I totally agree with that one.
I see a lot of it in like the Facebook groups and stuff like that. Sometimes people are just so set in their ways that they don't want to accept, you know, new findings or new evidence, you know, and things like that. So.
Mm-hmm. No, and I remember when I was first getting started in mead, I talked to other mead makers and we were like, yeah, I got a mead up to 20% one time. It's great. Like, so how did it taste? I don't care. It's 20% alcohol. I got drunk.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, or the old, congrats, I guess. I made a fantastic mead, but, you know, I used raisins as nutrients, you know, or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I feel like that's going away slowly but surely, but I could be wrong. Well, Michael, hey, thank you for hanging out with me and chatting through this afternoon here. And hey, also thank you to our listeners that are hanging out with us today. Hope you guys got something good out of this interview. And you want to drop me a line, you know how to find us. You can find us on the Facebook page, on our subreddit, or at info@themeadhouse.com. Until next time, guys, have a good evening, and we'll see you next time. Bye.